Hello, this is Daryl here, sending love as always. Thank you for tuning in. I just want to say, if you like this interview, you can check our website for companion workbooks, action guides, tools, checklists, templates, and show notes with links for everything mentioned on the call. Just visit bestbusinesscoach.ca. That's best, B-E-S-T, businesscoach.ca. Enjoy. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Matt Astafan, founder and creator of WebFriendly. WebFriendly is a media company focusing on news, trends, and insights for creators, publishers, and marketers. He's been online in various capacities since 2009. He's worked with some major players in the industry. And today we're talking to him about what it means for what the creator economy is and what it means for us moving forward. So Matt, how you doing, my friend? Long time no talk.
Thank you.
Hey, yeah. So obviously, I mean, you've worked with some big names. You've been involved in this industry at a deep level, you know, really even an early innovator and early adopter in a lot of things, which I want to get into. But before we even get into any of that, how did you get started? Like, were your parents entrepreneurs and marketers? Do you come from a family of business owners?
No, I was actually really into film, and I studied film and worked in the film industry. You know, in my early 20s, I wanted to be a movie director. Still want to do some movie directing maybe one day. And yeah, I was working there. And then a friend of mine became a real estate agent and convinced me to become a real estate agent. And I thought I would look really cool if I was a realtor. So I took the course, got the books, passed the test, became a realtor. And then I just failed miserably at real estate. I spent a year in real estate without making any money. By the end of the year, I had over $30,000 of credit card debt. And I was really struggling. So I went to my managing broker like around October and I was like, I got no sales skills. I got no marketing skills. Like, what should I do? You know, I was young. I was like 23 or something at the time. And he's like, you're young. He's like, why don't you go figure out this internet marketing stuff? So I did. And I also, you know, ended up starting a meetup and all this, you know, a meetup to have like a mastermind of people who are also studying marketing. It was actually, I got John Reese's Traffic Secrets 2.0. I think that was like the first $1 million weekend launch or something. I remember that. I think that was the hook on that one. And yeah, me and my friends like sat at my place and just watched these DVDs. The DVDs are like CD-ROMs. I don't even know. I just remember we were like sitting there watching and learning and stuff, you know, and then we formed this little mastermind and eventually I became better at marketing than real estate. So then I ended up quitting real estate. And my initial kind of venture into like entrepreneurship was I would teach these weekend workshops, like in-person workshops, teaching people how to set up their social media accounts, like literally logging in, signing up for Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, and then like making your profile, like writing your bio, like how to tweet, yeah. Stuff like that. And I did that for like
three years. What was the hot social media back then when you first got started?
When I first got started, Twitter was hot. Twitter had just got started. This is before Justin Bieber. Like I was like, I think when Justin Bieber got on, that made it hot. Then Oprah got on and then that made it really hot. And I think that was kind of like, yeah. And then like, I think when Justin Bieber, Shaq, Oprah, something like that. It was like when the celebrities started hitting Twitter, that's when it started really blowing up. And then, you know, after some years, it just became like a spam fest. And now I think Twitter's making a big comeback. So I'm happy about that.
Yeah. Yeah, for those that are joining in, this is being recorded around when Elon Musk just made a majority purchase of shares in Twitter. Super excited about that. Go freedom and free speech. I think that's a big step in the right direction. We'll see what happened. So, okay. So you started teaching people how to get social media and then where did things go from there? I mean, you became an overnight millionaire or?
So, you know, I started studying from digital marketers. I remember I met a friend of mine and this is kind of going way back, but I remember we were like, exchanging like who's your guru, right? Like who did you learn from? And my guru, my original guru was Gary V. Again, this is like 2009. This is like very early on. I remember when I followed Gary V. I still remember this. He had 30,000 followers on Twitter, and so I told my friend about Gary V. And then he told me about Eben Pagan, and then he gave me a disc that he had with Get Altitude, which was which in audio format, I think it's actually a video program. He gave me the audio of Get Altitude and Wake Up Productive. And those two programs completely changed my life. I've actually now met Eben and I've talked to, you know, people on his team and stuff. It was a big thing for me. I think like Get Altitude is like an MBA in a box. I don't even think you'd buy that anymore. I think it's like the best program he's ever made. I know he sells other stuff now, but I still think Get Altitude was the best. and then wake up productive as, you know, productivity and time management. And we were just talking before we started this about how we don't eat in the morning. And so I actually learned that from Wake Up Productive is that if you eat too much during the day, you'll get tired. So I always keep my meals when I'm working, I keep it under like 400 calories. And I learned that like 2009, you know? So that's how it kind of got started. And then I started doing more workshops and social media, and that just grew. And yeah, just one thing led to another. And I spent almost 10 years teaching social media.
Got it. Okay. So now what were some of the biggest challenges that you faced in your career and in getting online and doing all that? Because I mean, obviously, like you said, there was a learning curve. You had to follow gurus. I went to one of Eben's actual his events. I think it might have been a Get Altitude event. I don't even know. I was a plus one for it. I met a bunch of super cool people there. But what were some of the biggest challenges? Like if you had to go back, were there tears in your learning? Like first I had to learn this. Like you said, in real estate, you went 30 grand into debt. Hmm. You said, I don't know how to do marketing. I don't know how to do sales. So you know what I mean? Was there a progression? You know, were there levels that you kind of unlock, so to speak, as you've gone in your career?
I found that it's weird. You know, thinking back at early in my career, it was just always kind of, you know, making progress, going to the next level. I think there was a lot of knowledge that, you know, if I would have had it early on, I would have, you know, grew way faster, you know, because I was learning business as I was going, you know. As an example, like when I would get clients, I never really saw the value of like having clients on a subscription and systematizing things and hiring people to do things, you know, like when I was, you know, first getting started, you know, that I just thought like, I will do this project for you and you will pay me. And then I will do another project for you and you will pay me, you know? So, you know, there's, you know, it was just like, you know,
a lot of hungry months there.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it was funny. It was like in Canada, like I'm in British Columbia. It was funny because when I got started, the year I got started, there was all these grants available to the government that would pay you to get trained. And so because of that, I had an exceptional first year in business and second year business where like basically people would apply for a grant, take my course. And then I made a lot of money from these programs, right? So I was lucky that I was like, naturally getting into teaching courses. There was these grants available and, you know, so things were good, right? But those obviously washed up after some time. And then I realized like, wait a minute, like my sales are not as great as they used to be. And so then I had to kind of innovate and do more. That's when we kind of started moving the courses online and focusing more on like a global audience versus a local audience, right? But I would say like more recently, over the last few years, like between like 2016 and 2018, I started feeling like I didn't want to put myself out there as much, and I didn't want to continue growing a personal brand. And I struggled with it for a long time because I was a public speaker. I was always out there. I was always posting. I had absolutely no fear of putting myself out there or being famous or anything like that. And I think I got a little glimpse of what it was like to like become well-known or famous or whatever from some.
Yeah, and it's not all sunshine and rainbows.
Yeah. And then I started seeing what it was like. And I think, and I had a child and I started, you know, feeling a little bit more fear around kind of like what it's going to look like in 10 or 20 years. What is my son going to think about this? Or what if I say something wrong? And like, you know, all these kind of things, which are completely irrational fears. I think like the more I think about it, the more I think it's very irrational, and I'm a very rational person, you know? So I spent the last couple of years where I'm kind of working more like, you know, behind the scenes, and I actually really like it. I love like some of the most successful projects I've done is I was in the back doing the marketing and all the operations and everything else was being handled by the client. And I would get a percentage of the sales or they just pay me really well. And that was some of the best stuff because then I could just focus on the art, focus on the craft. And I love like the art of marketing. And I love being able to have that freedom where I'm just focused on the marketing and the messaging and like the customer journey and like all that. And when I get to do that, love it. And then, you know, in my own business, I also have to figure out the deliverability, the deliverables and like managing the clients and like all that, you know? And then it's like, it takes away from that, the art form of marketing. And so that's been kind of where I've been at over the last few years is like, you know, do I put myself out there? Do I not? And I tried a lot of different stuff of like how to not put yourself out there, but I just started this new show, Good Morning Marketers. And, you know, we're like 4 episodes in right now and already like my inbox is blowing up. And I just thought it was so interesting how fast it happened. Like the first 4 episodes, honestly, I don't think they're that good. you know, but just they're, everything's getting distributed. People are seeing it, whether they're watching it or not is, you know, they just see that I'm, you know, out there again, like, oh, Matt's back. And it's just so interesting seeing that, how fast that, you know, everything just like came back. So yeah, it's still an interesting, you know, exploration of like benefits, pros and cons of like being a personal brand versus not.
I definitely get that because I mean, I want the money. I don't want the fame, you know, because there's pros and cons that come with it.
Well, I want the freedom, you know, that's my thing too. It's like when I think about the money, it's like, you know, money's okay. Like I'm comfortable, whatever, but it's like, yeah, it's sometimes I feel like the fame, it takes away some of the freedom, you know, like
if definitely famous, does.
Yeah. If you're really famous, you can't go to the mall, you know, like stuff like that. Right. So.
And the problem is, you know, your income still goes up and down occasionally. Like there's people that are famous and they're broke. And they still have the security issues, right? Like those don't go away. Those don't cost any money because they live in other people's lives type thing. Other people have thoughts and feelings about you. I remember when I had my martial arts school, it changed my life in my hometown because before I was whatever, I just powwow around. But once I had a school, you know, I had hundreds of students and I had kids at my schools and stuff. So I remember I was out one Saturday night, you know, and this is before weed was legal in Canada. And I'd been drinking at the bar with my friends, like just a normal, 20-year-old kid, you know, like I wasn't a bar star or anything like that. But we go in the street and we go in the alleyway to smoke weed. And I remember going into the alleyway, some of my students came out the other side and I felt some type of way about it. I was kind of like, I'm supposed to be a role model. I don't know who's watching me. I don't know who's around. And we were like, guys, let's go home. Like, let's go home and finish the party at home type thing. But it was like that. Like, I felt like I couldn't, you know what I mean? Like let loose in public, so to speak. I've never been a big party guy. I moved out when I was 17 and worked nightclubs as soon as I turned 19. So I could see my friends on weekends. And after about a year of that, I was done with the bars. Cause I mean, you have 500 people in a nightclub. I'm dealing with the 20 people having the most terrible night out of all of them. You know what I mean? So I've never really been in drinking and all that. What would you recommend to someone that's starting out? Like, does that mean that they got to go out, they got to network, they got to be public, they got to put their face out there, they have to build a personal brand? Like, what did you learn then? I mean, you said you were able to be behind the scenes for a bit. So if someone's starting out online, whether it's e-commerce or a course or even a service, what do you recommend to them?
I mean, I can't say I would give the same recommendation to everybody, right? I think that the personal brand comes with, you know, more influence, more status. For sure, conversion rates go up like crazy. I remember when, you know, I did a lot of JVs, like JV webinars, that sort of thing. And when you do a JV with somebody who's like well-known, their conversions are through the roof. We won't mention the name, but we both have a mutual client we're working with, you know, looking at his stats. And like, I had never seen conversions so high on ads. I was like, he's just getting crazy click-through rates. Right. Cause he's well known, he's a podcast and, you know, he's an author, all that stuff. So there's definitely a benefit to it, but like, I don't think that everybody needs it. Right. I know a lot of very successful people who have businesses that are, nobody knows who the hell they are. Right. So it's not necessary. It's just that, you know, it's, to me, it's easier to build a personal brand and make money or get clients, you know, and so on. Or like, you know, like for me, even when I get client work, I'm never like out there trying to like run ads to get clients. I literally would just message some people and say, I'm available to know anybody, you know, or like, hey, do you want this thing? It's just, people just know me and they know that I'm just, you know, I'm cool, whatever. So I'm more so like selecting, you know, projects to do versus trying to like go out there and hunt for them. So, and it comes from my history of public speaking and videos and courses and content.
Yeah. And all that kind of stuff. And even who you worked with and all that. Okay. So what are some of the greatest mistakes then? Like you talk about marketing as an art form. What are some of the greatest mistakes you see business owners and clients and entrepreneurs making?
I guess, I mean, it really would depend on the kind of business. I mean, one thing is that, you know, trying to focus on getting the sale right away. I know for a long time I did that where I was chasing the sale. I was actually just talking to a friend about this. Like I had my agency going, we're doing really well, like earning like tens of thousands of dollars per month for me. That was really well at the time. And it gets to a point where like, I was like, oh, I want to make millions or I want to make a million, whatever. Right. And it's just very hard to like scale a service-based business like that, where you're not out there creating content and like building cult relationships, you know, with your audience and having people like you for your content you put out, whether it be your, you know, we talk a lot about like the difference between a creator and a publisher, right? Like a publisher is like a brand that's publishing content. A creator is like a person creating content, right? So whether you be a publisher or a creator, like I think that doing that is, it takes like 2 years to see the results. But then when you see the results, it's like exponential. I remember having, I had a friend of mine that I remember we were in a mastermind together, and he said that he was going to go all in on blogging and creating content. And I was like, no way, man. It's all about ads and funnels. Get the money, you know? And I saw him for 2 years, didn't make any money. You know, wasn't doing very well. And then 2 years later, blew up, right? And now I think he's worth like tens of millions of dollars, you know? So I think that that's the thing, is that a lot of businesses are focusing on ads and funnels and let's get the sale, that sort of thing. And it's good. You got to do that to stay in business, but you also need to focus on the content you're creating. Like you got to be a publisher, right? You got to be a creator, right? In order to really see it down the road, because you're going to get burned out in 2 years, even if you're making.
Well, it's funny. It's funny you mentioned Gary Vee before, because I remember one of Gary Vee's mastermind videos I was sent. He was talking about everybody needs to be producing 10 times more content than they are right now, but 80% of your focus needs to be on the ads that drive your business. And he's like, the two aren't, you can't do one without the other. And that was the thing. Like you need to pump out content. You need to pump out content and more content and valuable content and answer, you know, user questions and predictions of the industry and just news in general and helpful advice. So people get to know, and it fills your top of funnel, right? So for people that are just watching, there's like top of funnel, middle of funnel, bottom of funnel. And that's just the beginning. That's like just meeting someone and building a relationship with you or with them to the point where they're willing to buy. Top funnels, they've never heard of you. They don't know who you are. Middle of funnels, they're kind of getting to know you. And bottom of funnels where they feel like they can trust you and your friends, you know, and now they might be willing to do a purchase. And then there's also the whole in the business funnel where you've got the first sale, second sale, whatever, right? Like you talked about subscriptions and that, how long the relationship goes. But Gary Vee, that's what he's basically saying, is you got to use content, 10x your content production to help with the top, middle, and bottom of that funnel. But then you have to use the ads, because that's kind of an easier way. People, when they see an ad, they know it's an ad. And I think he didn't say this. I'm kind of now paraphrasing what I understood, but he was kind of saying like, when they see an ad, they're almost expecting the offer type thing, you know, and companies, when they put the ads in places, it just kind of saves your brand, so to speak, instead of always putting out content, buy my stuff, buy my stuff, buy my stuff. You can just be out there giving, and then you kind of market to those people the other stuff. By the way, if you're interested, XYZ.
Right. There's a lot of content creators who are either too focused on, you know, the content and never making the ask. And there's others that are always asking, like asking for the sale. So I think it's just important to have that balance for sure.
Is there a ratio? I know they used to say 90-10 in the old direct mail days. Or sorry, 80-20. And people just talk about newsletters. Newsletters, your newsletters should be 80% content, 20% ask.
Honestly, I think my approach would be to not do the ask in the content. If you're producing content, you could just retarget everybody who follows you or watches your videos with your ads. So that's probably going to be my approach to it. Like, we're just starting up this new show and doing this stuff, but like whenever we run ads, right, it's always like the first click never gets a sale. It's always the retargeting, right? So you build up the audience of people who click on your ads or, you know, your banner ads or whatever, but then like, and then you retarget them with more ads that, you know, and the strategy of those ads, you know, and the messaging could be slightly different, but then it's the retargeting that gets a sale. So I would say if you're producing a bunch of content, A, it should be, you know, whatever you offer has to be relevant to those people, right? But then you can just run ads to those people. They've seen your content. They know that channel, like on YouTube or the Instagram or whatever, wherever they're consuming your content is the channel where they go to get the content, right? And the value, whatever. Then the ads are where you have the ask. And I think it's okay to just always be running ads and retargeting everybody who consumes your content. I think it would work.
Now, what about some of the habits that you feel are the most important in this game, in running a business and trying to balance having kids and, you know, and clients and your own personal needs and desires?
I don't know. I mean, like for me, I just have my daily routine. I have some funny things that I do. Like in the morning, during the work week when I work, I always eat the same thing every day when I'm working. I always wear the same thing. And I actually just always do the same thing every day. And I don't know whether or not this is healthy. I don't know whether or not it's good. It works for me. I get up in the morning. I have a shake. I swallow a ton of vitamins. I go to the gym. If I'm running late, I just do 20 minutes on the Stairmaster. If I got time, I'll do some lifting, come back, make some coffee, and then I just work. And I try not to eat until like 4 o'clock. I have some fucking boiled eggs. And then I work until, you know, whatever, 6, 7 o'clock. And then I have my dinner. My dinner might vary. But that's been me. And I don't know if that works for everybody. I've told people about this before. A lot of people think it's weird. Some people think it's unhealthy to just eat the same thing every day. But yeah, that's been my routine.
Yeah, but that's like my favorite quote on mastery is do it until it becomes dull and then keep going until it's beautiful. You know, and perseverance is all the hard work you do when you're sick and tired from all the hard work you just finished doing, you know, and I think that's a grit thing. Like, I think there's a lot of people, they're like, there's two ways to look at it. One is like, oh, I need more stimulation than that. I need variety. But then there's also, can you just observe beauty in anything that you see, even if it seems dull and monotonous, you know, and that's almost like a focus thing. Could you have the mental capacity to focus on something for that long? I remember I was working, I was really on my grind, and I think I was sitting somewhere and I think I had a deadline. So I'd been in this chair for like 18 hours, just grinding out. And someone was like, how do you do that? And it was just like, I'm just really into what I'm doing and the details of it. And that's like, they say the devil's in the details. You know, the Inuit up north, they have 5 different words for snow because they know it so intimately, right? Like I get my fitness programming from the 5-time CrossFit Games champ, and some of the insight he has on simple things that I would do at the gym and just not think twice about. I'm like this guy has done it. Like, he has this 10,000 hours in this stupid, simple movement. Do you know what I mean? And so like just the nuance to it. And I really think that's what separates. I mean, virtue is doing the common uncommonly well. And you don't get that without grit, without that ability to maintain focus. You know, I always said, like, you can go make a new group of friends any day that want to sit around and talk small talk and drink and just let time fly. But how many people will sit beside you and focus on something, you know, like on a simple task or a simple project, and not need a break and not need to go home and take care of the pet, you know, like not need to do that sort of thing? It's a catch 22.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've always had that sort of like focus. Like, I get into something and I just get so into the zone and I keep thinking about it all day. And I think it's also because like I really enjoy what I do. So it's like my work is my hobby. Like, people might think it's like, oh, you have no life. All you do is wake up, go to the gym and work and then eat and go back to sleep, you know? And I was like, but like, that's like what I love to do. Like, it's what I want. I'm always doing what I want to do. You know, it's like, I just absolutely love it. And that's like, I don't know how to explain it. Like, I really have nothing else.
It's self-directed. Yeah. You're not showing up. Someone else necessarily tell you what to do. You do with your clients. You always have a boss. Your clients are your boss or whatever. But at the same time, you have enough clients that you can say bye to any of them. You know?
It's not like that. It's like, I'm just selective about it, right? Because it's like, I know there's no way I'm working with like a client from hell. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if I'm on like a sales call, it's like I'm deciding if I want to work with them or not.
The money's not worth it in some instances.
Yeah, but it's also like I'm not trying to like sell them on me. I'm trying to figure out if I want them. And I'm not saying that to be like cocky or something. It's just like I know I'm going to do a good job for them, and I know that they're making the right decision to hire me, I guess. So it's just like, you know, but then they're also like cool, right? Like, all my clients are cool. Like, I would just hang out with them. I don't, you know, I don't want people who are like nagging me and complaining. And, you know, I've actually have gotten rid of some clients because they were like,
Yeah, me too. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it. I totally get it. And not everyone's a fit, and that's okay. You don't want everyone to like you. Everybody wants everyone to like them, but the reality is you don't want everybody to like you, and that's okay. So, okay. Now, a couple other questions. So let's talk about the creator economy a bit. What is the creator economy? Why does it matter?
Creator economy is, maybe it's getting outplayed, that word. I think one of Gary Vee's book was called The Creator Economy, wasn't it? It was.
I don't know. Too.
I think his second book was called The Creator Economy. I just realized how played out that word is. But yeah, creators, to me, they're mostly YouTubers, but a creator could also be like a podcaster. Creators are usually a person who is producing content with them in it, right? Whereas like a publisher, you could look at like, you know, like Forbes or Business Insider. Those are like their publishers. They're also media companies. They're publishers, they're publishing content, but under like a brand, right?
Yeah, it's a brand, and they've got like a roster of creators, it seems like. Yeah.
So what I'm seeing with the creator economy is that it is going to blow up over the next few years. So right now, in terms of how much businesses, companies are spending by advertising directly with creators. So if you ever watch like a YouTube video and they're like, hey, thanks for watching. This video is sponsored by NordVPN. You know, you probably heard that one a lot, right? That's like company spending with creators. So right now, I think 2022, they estimated that it's a $17 or $18 billion industry. And it is estimated to be a $100 billion industry within 5 years. And what I think is going to happen is because of what happened with the cookie. So Safari, Apple, originally it was on mobile Safari. Now it's on all of Safari. Apple killed the cookie because of privacy issues, right? Google says they're phasing out the cookie by the end of this year or early next year. So the cookie's going away. So personally, I had on webfriendly.com, I had a lot of affiliate links on these articles, and we used to make about $2,000 a month from all these links and all the traffic we're getting. When they killed the cookie and more than half of our traffic was on I think 80% of our traffic was on mobile because we used Google AMP and other things. We're really optimized for mobile. And now we make less than $200 a month, right? So it really killed the, like I was all about, oh, let's make blog posts with affiliate links. Let's grow this, right? And totally killed it. So the cookie's going away. And also it killed Facebook. So anyone who's been following the news about the cookie, that's why Facebook is very mad at Apple. And that's why they also, their sales or their, you know, revenue has gone down. And so what I think is going to happen is because of the tracking and the precision targeting and all that stuff that the cookie gave us, and there's solutions in place for like the next cookie that's going to come out. There's a lot of different technologies that are being discussed right now.
But like that's email.
What's that?
Like email hashes.
I don't know about email hashes.
Oh, we can get into that after. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Anyways, there's like different technology that they're talking about that they might use, but it's going to take a few years. So in the meantime, I think that the best way to target people is through these creators. So creators have their data and analytics that maybe YouTube gives them, for example, and they know what kind of audiences they have. They're making content for certain audiences, and you can go direct to them and say, hey, do you want to work together? I'll pay you this much and you give me a shout out on the video. And, you know, I was also looking at different tech incubators. Like there's like Techstars, 500 Startups, Y Combinator. And I was actually going through looking at what kind of startups people were building. And what I noticed was like, I'm not even exaggerating. I think around half of all the startups had to do with connecting creators with brands. So a lot of people are working on this. FameBit, which launched in 2009, I think, or 2010.
What is it?
It's called, it was called FameBit. I think it was 2010. I forget the exact year, but Google bought them. And now if you go to YouTube, I think it's YouTube Partners, is actually originally the FameBit software that would connect brands with creators. So this whole idea of connecting brands with creators is the next phase of advertising. And I think that that is what every creator is now, a media company. And so I think it's going to be bigger and bigger that brands are going to be working with creators. And what's great about it right now, it's the wild, wild west, right? You're not going into a platform and running an ad and then sending it, you know, to these creators. They actually have platforms like that for podcasts, right? There's a lot of platforms that you can run. It's called dynamic ad insertion.
Right.
Where you could record an ad and then you could say, I want to place it in podcasts about this, and it's all automatic. So they've done that for podcasts. And of course you could advertise directly on YouTube, right? But in terms of getting the working directly with a YouTuber and having them promote your product, that sort of thing, it's just, it's blowing up. It's going to be a really big industry. And a lot of these YouTubers are also launching their own brands and products. We've talked a lot about this on our podcast, like who's going to be the first billionaire YouTuber. It's going to be Mr. Beast, you know?
Mr. Beast, easy. Yeah, I was about to say that. I
think Mr. Beast, so but I also got my money on the Nelk Boys and Gary Vee. So
Gary Vee and who?
The Nelk Boys, Full Send.
I don't know
Full Send podcast, Nelk Boys. Yeah, so they launched their own seltzer.
I know Full Send. Okay.
Yeah, so they launched a seltzer called Happy Dad. And the seltzer industry right now is a $5 billion industry. So I think that they are going to grow Happy Dad over the next 2 to 5 years and sell it for $1 billion. That's my prediction. So because when they made Happy Dad, they didn't call it Full Send Seltzer. They called it Happy Dad. It's completely detached from their brand, which tells me that they're going to sell it. And they've talked about how the seltzer industry is a $5 billion industry and it's growing like rapidly, right? So that's why I got my money on, I would say. And Mr. Beast is spending all of his money. That's the other thing too. If Mr. Beast goes public or does like a DAO or something like that, maybe he'll be the first billionaire YouTuber. But I think he's just going to keep on growing for like 10 years and he'll be like the Disney of YouTube, you know?
Yeah. One of the things that he's done that I saw when I was living in Vietnam, we saw all these because I just had a baby and we started getting to these kids' YouTube channels. And one of the things that I saw was some of these huge kid YouTube channels. They were in 7 different languages. It was the same videos. They just had voice dubs. And then that's when I saw Mr. Beast on Rogan, he just started doing that. He just did that, started doing that like a year or two ago, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, 2 years ago. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Even like Neil Patel talks about that too. He's like the low-hanging fruit for more traffic through Google is translations. And he got big into like translating in Brazil. Like Neil Patel is really big in Brazil. Right. I don't know what the language he did, but he was all about that. He's like, he had so many blog posts. All he did was translate everything into all these different markets. Right. So it's definitely, And there's so much less competition in those other markets. Advertising in those markets is way cheaper. Yeah. Like it's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And their money spends as good as anybody else's, you know? So I love that you brought this up and you kind of gave a little bit of a tip and insight into the future, but can you talk a little bit more about where you think the future of the industry is going? So you think each creator is now their own media company. You think that brands pairing with creators is going to be kind of helping replace, you know, like the Facebook, you know, the Facebooks of the world, so to speak, where you've got one self-serve ad platform because you're going to lose that targeting to the same level. Cause a lot of Facebook's unique targeting comes from tracking what happens off of Facebook, right? I mean, they've got hundreds of millions of sites with their Facebook pixel. And so when you're on Facebook and go do a bunch of other things, they're watching you. People don't realize that, but Facebook's watching what everybody's doing. Cause all these sites have pixels and it's like, you know, a signal. It tells them where you're at, where you're not. And you say that that's all going away. And so all of a sudden Facebook can only really know what data they buy, but also mostly just like what you're doing on Facebook and what you've told them, your profile data and that. And so you think what you've seen with these startups is it's really, there's going to be this kind of influencer marketing is going to be the next big thing. Is that what you're trying to say here?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I think there's a lot of platforms. A lot of people are trying to get into this market. YouTube already bought their company that does it. It doesn't have that yet. Facebook will likely acquire one of these startups that's connecting the creators on Facebook and Instagram and so on, and then connecting them with the brands. It could look like something like what the podcast industry did. You know, it could be like a script that you give them that says, hey, you read this on your show. I don't know how they're going to really manage all that, like to know that it got done or whatever. Right now, a lot of these, you need a brand manager, like a big creator would have a brand manager that you would talk to. And then you'd, you know, they'll work on an average CPM of their viewership, something like that. So yeah, I think that's it's going to get more and more molded. So once you become like, you know, once you're a YouTube partner or like once you get to a certain stage in your career, a certain audience level, you know, you're going to be able to join some platform where you can connect with brands and, you know, it might be some direct messaging, talking, discussing that way versus a self-serve platform. Probably something like that.
What do you think about Web3 and like DAOs? Do you think that that's a thing that's going to be more prominent? Do you think it's a phase?
Yeah, I think, you know, if it gets, I mean, what's going to happen is probably if it gets, I don't know a whole lot about it, to be honest, to be able to speak like very intelligently about that house. But, you know, if it becomes legal and all that, to be able to do that and raise money that way, which I think it would be. I think I could see it going that way. It would be interesting for companies to raise money in that capacity, but it'll also be the wild, wild west, just like what we just saw with the whole NFT stuff over the last year.
Yeah.
It was like 95, 99% trash. And now people are adding more utility to their NFT, which makes sense to me.
Yeah.
They buying the monkeys and all that kind of stuff. Now the whole monkey thing, you know, became a utility. Now you're part of a club and it's like the billionaire boy club, you know? So yep. I could see that, but a lot of this kind of like buying, you know, I was thinking like I collect retro toys. Like you can see behind me here, like I got a lot of retro toys I collected. I just found like a 2006 Darth Vader piggy bank. It's like on my kitchen right now. I just got it today. And what's unique about that is like, if you want it, you got to buy it, right? Whereas like collecting an image of, you know, of a monkey or something is like, I don't need to own it. If I want to like print out a big monkey picture and hang it on my wall. I could literally just go and take the image and then, you know, find a good file of it, you know, and print it. I don't need to buy it in order to like enjoy looking at it. Right. But when you come to like sports cards or collectibles, and the reason why all those are kind of going up in value is because of the nostalgic effect of like having that stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's where I think like the NFTs and kind of like, you know, for artists and all that, you know, I'm not too sold on that, but when it comes down to utilities and being part of a club and a part
of that part makes sense. Yeah. Like an NFT where you're an early founder in something, therefore you get VIP privileges, and your NFT is your ticket for that. It's your proof. It's your wristband, you know, that can't be fudged. That part makes a ton of sense. I know some guys that are doing that. Yeah.
So do you ever buy lifetime deals like on AppSumo?
Yeah.
So you can get like a software instead of paying a monthly fee, you pay a one-time fee and you get access to the software. There's like a black market of people buying and selling deals like through Facebook groups, stuff like that. And I actually messaged Noah Keegan, he's the founder of AppSumo. And I was like, hey, instead of having this black market where people are getting ripped off, there's a whole bunch of stories about whatever, you know.
Right.
Some people like actually figured out what all the codes were for this one software and started selling those codes, and they didn't figure it out for months. So people paid for this codes, and the company that people had access to, they were like, hey, these were, you know, you were not supposed to get these codes. So they ended up like deactivating these people's accounts, but they're like, hey, you should have been better to like secure it. So that way someone couldn't go out and do the scam. Anyways, the point being is I told Noah Keegan, I'm like, it'd be great if these LTDs, these lifetime deals, were sold as an NFT. When we buy an LTD, right, we're in a way investing into the business because we believe that it will be around for the future. That's where we're getting it, right? And if people want to resell it, well, hey, I have an LTD for a product that, like, some people bought LTDs for like Dropbox like 10 years ago. That sort of stuff, right? That could be worth a lot of money. Right?
Yep.
So it'd be great to like buy software as an NFT. Right. And like as a software company, you could be like, hey, I'm going to give away 1,000 NFTs for lifetime access to this product. You pay $100 now, but hey, we're going to be in business in the next 10 years. That $100 could be worth way more. Right. Imagine you had like a lifetime deal to like Salesforce or HubSpot or like something like that. And you bought it very early on. Right. So I think it'd be great to see NFTs in the software industry. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. 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 So we talked about habits. We talked about where this future of where the industry is going. Who are some of your role models that you look to in the space to keep an eye on?
Yeah, it's better now. Role models, man. I don't know.
Or at least, who do you look up to? Who's your guru?
Who's my guru now? Who do I watch now? Man, I'm more in the observing phase. Like I love observing. Like I've been watching a lot of like Nelk Boys and that sort of thing. They're not marketing, they're not in the marketing niche, but I love observing what they're doing in business. And they don't talk about it directly, but as a business person, I kind of recognize what they're doing. And I think that's very interesting to me. I've been observing a lot of the community space and community softwares, people who both manage and build communities and then softwares for it. There's not a really good, like, I've done a lot of copywriting for LMS softwares, like learning management softwares. And I think the aspect of community is probably one of the best ways to increase your course completion rates and reduce your cancellations and refunds. Get a community. I actually think that selling a community with a course as like the second tier thing will probably sell better than I have a course plus you get access to the community. I think the community is more valuable, and there's not a really good LMS, SaaS LMS, I should say. Like we talked about this before before we're talking about WordPress based ones. I'm not a big fan of that, but based on like SaaS, right? So we got like, there's like Kajabi, there's ClickFunnels, people use that for their LMS. There's Teachable, you know, Udemy, right? These are all LMSs, but no one's really mastered courses plus community.
Right.
Muddy Networks is one. I personally don't like the UI and so on of their community feature. I'm in another program where they tried to hack together Circle. It's like circle.co. which is more of a community thing, but they tried to put courses into it. Didn't really work. There's tribe.so, which is more of like a forum community thing and not for courses. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting seeing that space. And I've been just kind of like observing both the entrepreneurs and the platforms and just kind of what's going on there. And I think there's still a big gap of doing it right.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's an important thing, because a lot of people have lost faith in social media. You know, a ton of users have jumped ship from Facebook. And we know there's all sorts of new platforms coming out. There's like the Signal and the Telegram. And I think there's a new one, Truth or Trust or something. So it's kind of like you said, I think community is a huge part of it. And it's almost like we built up these big centralized bodies. I don't know what's going to happen with these big centralized networks, but some of them are being fragmented. And now we've got more small players. And it's almost like what you're saying with the creator economy and brands, speaking of them, it's this ebb and flow between consolidation and dispersion, you know, dispersing. And I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think that's an important one. We haven't talked about that, but as a business owner, no matter what business that you're in, you're building a community of some sort, right? Like you really are. Even if you're just installing pools for people, even if you're just doing, if you're a dentist, like you're dealing with families, you're building a community. And so that's I'm just glad that you brought that up. Even talking about DAOs, that's a decentralized autonomous organization, for people that heard us talking about it, wasn't sure what it was. The idea is that it's an organization of kind of volunteers that get a percent ownership, so to speak, of the company for their work. And it's kind of like a merit-based, it's supposed to be a merit-based organization, but it's still a Wild West, because it's kind of the same issue is, how do you sort everybody? How do you acknowledge people over others? You know, how do you reward merit? How do you track it? How do you value the contribution people make? And it's the same thing with the community, like you talk about. Like it's the community, there's a lot of value in the community. But I mean, I recently inherited a Facebook group of 83,000 people, but it's kind of dead. There's new people joining every day. It wasn't like a venture that I engaged in. Someone just kind of approached me and was like, hey, guy's been running it for like 10 years, I think. Hey, I've just really lost control of it these few years. You know, can you help? And I'm like, I don't know, but it's like, so many people are focused on the marketing and sales, like you said, but like you also spoke to, it's about building the relationship. And part of that is the long-term relationship, having a ongoing relationship with people where you do business together, where you transact and you trade, and that's building a community. Can you speak to that? And I think you've got some insight, because some of the clients you've had in the space and also your background on social media, some of the pillars, like if somebody heard you talk about community spaces and these softwares and they were interested at all, and especially as a creator, you're creating content for your community. Are there pillars for that? Are there fundamentals?
Well, I think one thing, just to go back a bit, is like, I think that niche social networks are going to be the future of social media. So more niche stuff. So a community just for business people, a community just for people in the city or town, or people who are only into learning about community. The way that Facebook groups were set up, I could see all those being their own sort of networks, private networks. Before we would do online courses, it was difficult to use anything but a Facebook group, because people were just on Facebook naturally. And so to try to get them to use something else was very difficult. Whereas now, I think people prefer it, right? The challenge is with all these niche platforms is that they're not mobile first. And if you look at any of the stats for any social network, Facebook is 90% mobile usage. Twitter is 80. YouTube, I think, is like 60. Actually, I happen to know all this. So it's like 65. Instagram is 100. TikTok is 100. You know, like they're all mobile first, right? And so the problem is that all these, they're not mobile first platforms. And so even though they might even have a mobile app, but the app sucks and doesn't have all the features and so on. And that's the challenge with this. A lot of people have been moving towards Discord, right? Discord groups. In the past, I've seen groups in Slack channels, stuff like that. So those are other kind of options, but there's not a really good thing. And in terms of like, you know, Web3, and the people have been talking about Web3 being the future social. There's a platform called Diamond App. I think it's diamond.app. And it's the first kind of one big one kind of taken off in terms of the Web3 space. You could join it, and then it's like a decentralized social network, you know, that sort of thing. I actually think it's interesting. I joined it. I was like kind of poking around, but I didn't really stick into it. But yeah, I mean, what happens is if you have people joining your community around a common cause, mission, goal, whatever, you know, what I've seen work in the past anyway is if you're doing, for example, like a weekly webinar or event, there's a place where you're always bringing people together and then they go to, you know, the network part to go and like network and meet each other and so on. You're going to hit like a tipping point where they just go there naturally to engage, right? I'm in a group now. It's like it's part of a program for building a startup. They're using Circle. And people are very engaged. I actually joined the program for the community aspect, not even for the content. And people are very engaged in using it. So I really like that people are there. And every week there's a webinar and they're teaching and so on. It goes on for 12 weeks, very engaged. But what I really got disappointed is like in the app, it's like so bad. Like when someone likes your post, you can't see who liked it. You can't go to their profile. It's when you try to message somebody, it doesn't refresh by itself. There's so many issues with the app that it's like, I cannot use the app to like on the go. So I just check it once in a while when I'm on my computer, you know? And so I think if you bring people in slowly, not fast, and they're coming in because of us, you know, it would be great with a course, I think, you know, they're coming in for a purpose, like to come in every week, you're going to do a webinar, or some sort of a meetup, mastermind. And you grow it up slowly. Don't worry about getting big numbers. That way the people who are there are using it and are engaging. Then when new people come in, they're like, oh, I can see how this works now. Everyone's talking about this or talking about that. And, you know, you can easily reach out to people. They could see an example of what it would look like to engage in this community. But when they first come in there and there's nothing there, it's crickets, right? So you got to start really slow. I think that's the key is what I've seen anyways of how things start.
Yeah, okay, that's a really good tip. Now, I want to be respectful of your time. I know we already started a little bit late. So before we wrap up, is there anything I didn't ask you that I should have asked you?
Well, I guess like right now, what I've been working on is the YouTube show, Good Morning Marketers, which is also a podcast. And something interesting that we've been doing with it is I've been handling all the pre-production, so planning the shows. It's a news show, right? So it's a news and entertainment show for creators, publishers, marketers, right? So I've been trying to avoid teaching, you know? I don't want it to be an education show, right? We want to get more into entertainment type stuff, right? So I've been handling the pre-production. Then both me and Andrew, who's the co-host, Andrew Murdoch, we do the production together because we're filming together. We figured out kind of logistics of like how to record it. We've been using Riverside.fm, which looked very promising, but oh my God, do I not like it? I hate to say it because I was so excited when I found it. I was like, this is going to be the Zoom killer. This is it, you know? And it's like, has so many problems. And so I don't know. There's got to be something better of like, how do you record a show with multiple cameras and multiple speakers? It's like, I haven't figured this out yet, but you know, we're still going through it. And then there's the post-production, which, you know, Andrew handles all the editing or whatever. But what we do is we end up making, we got our full episode. We take all the stories, become individual clips. And then we create short clips, 1-minute videos, both in story format and in a square format. So that way it could work on uploading into Instagram, into the feed, into stories, into reels, into TikToks. We upload directly onto Twitter and onto LinkedIn. And we created this whole distribution, right? So what we figured out was if anyone's out there and you want to become a creator, I think news and doing a news show is where it's at. I think doing news for your niche. There's not a lot of niche news shows, right? People think about news like politics, stuff like that, but doing news for your industry. If you're a chiropractor, you do news that matters to chiropractors. If you're, you know, whatever, like those kind of niche shows, you film for an hour, you come up with maybe 5 to 7 topics. I figured out that when you do over 7, it becomes very hard to distribute because we just do one a day. Once you're over 7, you got to do more than one a day. It just becomes harder to schedule. So do 5 to 7 topics. Then you just chop it up into videos and then you know, distribute it and so on. And we just started this and we just figured out all the logistics of how to do it all, whatever. But now that we kind of figured out, okay, now we know how to distribute it. Now our next phase, okay, now how do we grow all these accounts, start getting more and more traction? And that's kind of our next stage for this. But I think that is something, if someone's looking to kind of get into the space or creating content, covering news is so easy because you don't have to like think, what am I going to teach people and what kind of tip am I going to get, right? Just react. It's a reaction channel. You know, it's a reaction show. It's like news. You're reacting to the news, right? What's happening in the industry. You're explaining, you're connecting the dots, right? You're explaining the news and you're connecting the dots of why this matters to your industry. And yeah, I've seen a few people do it in some formats. Like if you remember Ray William Johnson equals 3, he used to kind of do this. He was reacting to viral videos, and he would do like 3 viral videos an episode. It was like a funny show, and it's a reaction channel, right? Mr. Beast has one of his channels called Mr. Beast Reacts, and he's reacting to like basically like memeable content, you know, short videos, TikTok, stuff like that. It's just reacting, right? So I think that that in that format will work really well for a lot of industries. And I don't see, like, I've actually searched a lot about this, like how many niche news shows there are, and there's not a lot. And I think that it's a great opportunity, very easy to do.
That's a great tip, especially in an era where a lot of us have developed a distaste and distrust for mainstream media.
But that's the thing is, like, it's not about doing, like, you could do a politics and, you know, whatever, that kind of news too, right? But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying, like, for your industry, right?
Yep. Okay. Well, Matt, I appreciate your time today. I appreciate you joining us here. For those that are interested, go check out webfriendly.com. Webfriendly.com. And is that also what they can Google or YouTube?
Yeah, we're youtube.com/webfriendly. Well, I'm actually /webfriendly everywhere. Instagram.com, webfriendly. TikTok/webfriendly. Twitter, webfriendly. I got the username everywhere. Lock that down.
Like, I got the distribution.
I got the trademark. I could use that now. I own Webfriendly. I paid a lot of money
Webfriendly.
For that.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Matt, thank you so much. It's been an honor and a pleasure. This was a great call. I really appreciate your time. I appreciate your patience. I know we had a couple of tech issues in the beginning. And yeah, I'd love to have you back and talk some more.
Awesome. Thank you.